You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017.
With that comes this whole Western expectation of we're going to modernize, we're going to change the way your culture is.
Last night, President Trump addressed the nation, calling for an additional 4,000 troops to be deployed to Afghanistan. Bloomington author Doug Wissing has been in the South Central Asian country numerous times since 2001. WFHB correspondent Michael Glab speaks with Wissing about the conflict later in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, resources for those working with family members who have suffered from brain trauma. That's coming up on Everyday People, a weekly segment aimed at improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County. But first, these local headlines.
Jim Sims was elected to the Bloomington City Council last night by the Monroe County Democratic Caucus. Sims is taking over the City Council at Large seat formerly held by Tim Mayer. Mayer announced his departure from City Council, a position he held for 19 years, on July 31st.
First of all, I've served with Tim the last several years on the Utility Service Board, and I think I was shocked, or surprised, I guess is a better word, when we all found out that he had decided to resign. I just thought there was an opportunity to put myself in a position to maybe be of more service to the community, add some diversity to city government, and just do what I can to help. I think over the years, last 20 years or so, I've served on numerous city, county, church, Indiana University, MCCSC committees and school boards, and I think all of that work and those relationships that we've built prepared me to move to the next step of serving on the council.
Sims is the second African-American to serve on the Bloomington City Council since Paul Swain's tenure in 1991.
My perspective, I think, is like the rest of the council members, and that is to represent our constituents and the community. But what I do think, in particularly Democrats, with our progressive approach, the way we view social justice, you know, and civil rights, I think what it will do is just let others know, I think, throughout the community, those that may be a little bit hesitant, understand that the Democratic Party in particularly, and I hope myself is included, that we are now more inclusive, more inviting, more open to community input. We just want to invite more people under the tent.
Sim says he's excited to work with city council members and hopes his appointment will help community members get involved.
There's a lot going on in the city, from the homelessness issue, from some affordable housing, living wages, our comprehensive growth plan. What are we going to do with repurposing the old hospital facility downtown when it is vacated? Infrastructure issues. Though I would hope that the community feels as comfortable or even more comfortable in giving their input to the city council members and those representatives so that we can do the best job in making the best decision we can for all involved.
The next city council meeting takes place tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Showers Building.
Yesterday, the Bedford and Lawrence County Times-Mail ran an editorial piece submitted to them by Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. Hill's office widely circulated the opinion piece, which criticized efforts at providing clean needles and paraphernalia to addicts, called needle exchanges. Hill applauded Madison and Scott counties for downgrading their needle exchange programs, claiming that needle exchange programs encourage, quote, addicts from all over the state to visit to acquire free paraphernalia, unquote. Hill's piece continued claiming, quote, overall, Madison County officials came to discern the basic folly of distributing dangerous needles without any reasonable degree of accountability, unquote. The Indiana Recovery Alliance is a nonprofit needle exchange in Bloomington. IRA Director Chris Ebert says it's seen the same statements from Hill over and over again.
Everything I've read that he has stated falls under the category of moral panic or political posturing or cherry-picking certain events without context, and then offering those as data and or research or conclusive evidence. That's worrisome for me, that someone who's our attorney general would so haphazardly use anecdote and personal opinion for something that has, you know, 30 years of evidence behind it.
One of Hill's claims that needle exchanges hand out more needles than they receive is particularly troublesome for Ebert.
The answer to that is that the police continue to arrest people and take their syringes. How would you possibly bring back your syringes if the police have confiscated them after arresting you for getting syringes from a state-sanctioned needle exchange? When those numbers are put out, there no consideration is given to the fact that if I have 20 people come in every week, let's say five of those people are new, well, those five people don't have an opportunity to bring back their syringes. So there's never going to be an even number. That's not even the point of syringe access anyway. The IV drug use is far too criminalized to expect, and continues to be criminalized, to expect people are going to be able to bring back their syringes and not be arrested. Constantly in Monroe County, our participants are arrested with syringes that they were going to bring back. So I would say that he contributes to that problem legislatively, and then points to that as some type of evidence that the program isn't working.
In his editorial piece, Attorney General Hill stated that, quote, drug users receiving clean needles reported injecting themselves more frequently after the start of the program, from five times a day on average to nine times a day, unquote. Ebert says that statement is also disingenuous.
When they started the needle exchange in Scott County, they asked people how many times they used per day, and then they gave them that many syringes. So you could only have as many syringes as you said you used. Well, when people realized that their syringes were tied to, the number they could get were tied to how many they said that they used a day, then they said that they used more to get more syringes. So he doesn't tell that. Again, he cherry picks this data. What he's doing is dangerous. It kills people. It will ultimately hurt our community in increased hepatitis C, increased HIV. He also talks about how syringe exchanges are giving out everything except for the heroin. A very, very cursory understanding of the transmission of hepatitis C will show that the majority of those transmissions happen in the equipment that aren't syringes. So the spoons, the tourniquets, the cottons, all of those other things that are given out are given out with an epidemiological purpose.
Indiana's needle exchange program originally met with stiff resistance from Republican lawmakers, including then-Governor Mike Pence. Indiana's needle exchanges were championed by Indiana State Health Commissioner Jerome Adams. Adams was nominated to U.S. Surgeon General by President Donald Trump and was confirmed earlier this month. He's announced his health priorities include combating the opioid epidemic.
The wreckage of the USS Indianapolis, a World War II heavy cruiser that fought in the Pacific, was discovered this weekend on the floor of the Philippine Sea. Billionaire Microsoft investor Paul Allen and his team found the wreckage of the Indianapolis 72 years after the ship was torpedoed and sunk by an Imperial Japanese Navy submarine. The ship's final mission before being torpedoed in the dead of night was the successful delivery of the atomic bomb Little Boy to the U.S. Air Base in Tinian.
You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes. Black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you, and those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.
The Indianapolis was popularized in 1975 by the Steven Spielberg film Jaws. In it, a former Indianapolis sailor, Quint, recounts the horror of surviving at sea after the cruiser's sinking. After torpedoes hit, the ship went down in 12 minutes. Of the nearly 1,200 men aboard, approximately 900 survived the initial sinking. 4 days later, exposure, dehydration, saltwater poisoning, and shark attacks left only 300 men alive to be rescued. The guns and prow of the USS Indianapolis's sister ship, the battleship USS Indiana, rest at IU Memorial Stadium. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Last night, President Trump called for the nation to funnel more troops and more money into Afghanistan. In his address, the president called for the outright defeat of ISIS and al-Qaeda while making brief references to the Taliban. Author Doug Wissing has spent many months embedded with U.S. Army units venturing out into outlying Afghanistan regions where he learned who the enemy and who our friends are.
I went out there 3 times and embedded with different Army units around the east and south of Afghanistan where the insurgency is raging.
The reason we bring this up is your latest book, published by IU Press, Hopeless But Optimistic. It is about what goes on in Afghanistan. And what the heck is it about Afghanistan that keeps pulling you back?
That's a great question. I've had a long interest in Central Asia. Of course, IU has a great Central Asian program, and I had done a lot of research in Tibet initially, wrote a book called Pioneer in Tibet about an early explorer of Tibet who introduced Tibet to America, who was a Hoosier, as a matter of fact, went out there in the early, very early 20th century. And I've spent a fair amount of time in the Pashtun regions prior to 9/11, so I had some sense of the Pashtun people, who are the insurgent group in Afghanistan, primarily that they comprise the Taliban. So I had some sense of those folks before the war started in 2001. And I find mountain people fascinating, and both the Tibetans and the Pashtuns are certainly that. So I had some understanding of certain dynamics in Central Asia, and I had run across an army team, what are called farmer soldiers. They were agribusiness development team that were comprised of National Guardsmen who were going out to Afghanistan to do development work, win hearts and minds, or WAM in the military acronym.
Right.
They were doing WAM work, trying to convince Pashtun farmers up in the mountains in Taliban country that they should ally with the Afghan government, the U.S.-supported Afghan government, by doing development work. And these teams were comprised of about 65 soldiers, generally elite soldiers that were both military people and agricultural specialists. And they were unique in the Afghanistan war because they were development teams that had their own security. So they had their own armored vehicles. They had their own security teams. They could go out whenever they wanted. So 90% of the American soldiers never leave the bases, never break the wire.
Right.
The agribusiness development teams did just the opposite. They did hundreds of missions out into Afghanistan. And I embedded with a number of those teams from different states, Texas, Kentucky, Kansas, Mississippi, South Carolina, Indiana, 3 different times. And they were strategically positioned through the war zones. So because they were doing development, because they were involved with combat missions, because they had to then coordinate with all the combat teams, because they were involved with the Afghan government, because they were essentially negotiating with the Taliban shadow government out in the villages to do the development projects, you saw every aspect of the war in Afghanistan, including what's called the civ-mil combinations, the military-civilian combination. So there were frontline diplomats out there. And you got to see all of that. It was a great lens to look at the entire war. And it was why I stuck with those teams.
So here's a population of people that's fairly isolated. They're living in mountains. They're living in an almost unknown corner of the world, unknown to us here in America generally. And in come strangers trying to tell them what to do. How does that work?
Well, if you can imagine, you're in a convoy of armored vehicles, typically a minimum of five. So these are kind of rolling bank vaults, grinding up these switchbacks into these essentially 13th century villages. And the security soldiers get out. You have to, your security platoon gets out first. And they're dressed in 50 pounds of body armor. They're carrying 75 pounds of weaponry and ammunition. There's machine gunners on top of the armored vehicle. Sometimes there's going to be an Apache helicopter circling above. And the Afghans come out and they sit down with you under the shura tree, under the meeting tree, the shade tree at the edge of the village. And then these kind of stormtroopers start saying, well, do you want this project? Do you want that? We have this idea. And you know, with that comes this whole Western expectation of we're going to modernize. We're going to change the way your culture is.
And who wouldn't want that in our view, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And sometimes I tell people, well, this would be how it would be. Imagine 8-foot-tall Taliban on armored flying carpets, and they come swooping in and tell all our women to put on burqas.
Wow.
And I'd be thinking the shotguns would be coming out.
Right.
And that's kind of what happens in Afghanistan.
Support for WFHB comes from Bloomington Pride, presenting Pride Fest on August 26th in downtown Bloomington. The festival celebrates LGBTQ community and culture and features a Pride rally, education workshops, live performances, family activities, and local vendors. Details on Facebook and at bloomingtonpride.org/pridefest.
Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News also comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet voice and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Coming up next, WFHB's weekly community resources segment, Everyday People.
Don't mess around.
Welcome to Everyday People, improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County.
Everyday resources for everyday people, connecting our community by sharing resources you need, want, and probably don't know about.
Hi, today we have Jean Kapler again. Welcome back, Jean.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Sure, thank you. Jean is with the Rehabilitation Hospital of Indiana. What brings you with us today?
Well, I think we're going to do a little talking about family and friends of people who've had a brain injury. And I do a lot of work with family and friends of folks who've had all kinds of different brain injuries. And when we're talking about brain injury, we're really talking about traumatic brain injury. A lot of people think about traumatic brain injuries, but also injuries like stroke, possibly a loss of oxygen to the brain, maybe after a heart attack or near drowning or a drug overdose sometimes, electrocution, even brain tumors and brain surgery cause brain injuries.
Right.
And so it's just a whole, there are a whole lot of ways we can injure our brain.
Sure.
And that affects not just the person, but their family members and their friends, because when the brain has been injured, a lot of times the person functions differently afterwards.
Right.
And then that affects their relationships with people and their roles in the family and you know, the range of activities that they can do like they used to. And we try to provide, while we do services for folks with brain injuries, we also try to provide supports and education for family and friends.
So that everyone is sort of aware of what may happen and how mm-hmm. things can change and mm-hmm. sort of feel, I don't know if it's more comfortable, but have some awareness of what might mm-hmm. be down the road as this injury heals or changes.
Exactly, because it's very confusing and people can misinterpret why a person does what they do mm-hmm. after a brain injury. And as a family member, I can speak personally, mm-hmm. you know, years ago when I was in college, my dad had a pretty severe stroke.
Right.
And was paralyzed on the left side of his body. But it also caused personality changes, changes in his ability to think mm-hmm. and formulate what he wanted to say. And so the changes that I saw were differences in independence. He was suddenly very dependent. We had to help him with everything. We did a lot of caregiving for him.
Was that frustrating for him?
I think it was frustrating for him, but he didn't quite, wasn't able to process it fully.
Right.
And, you know, it was really hard for us, too, to see him in that state. And we wanted to help it. You know, it caused tremendous changes in our family. We couldn't rely on him for all the things we relied on our dad for.
Yeah.
And, you know, his income into the family was lost. And so, and then our, you know, we were doing actual hands-on caregiving as well. And nobody told us anything about what to expect, why he would be different, mm-hmm. how to interpret those changes in his personality. Yeah. And so we just kind of muddled along the best we could.
Just figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that made it, I mean, it's hard enough anyway, but
right.
I think that made it 100 times harder.
Sure.
To not understand and not know what supports could be out there. We really emphasize education of family and even friends, you know, if friends are involved.
Absolutely.
We'll educate whoever.
So you find a lot of people are open to the idea of, yes, I want to learn about this and
yeah.
I want to.
Families are hungry for learning about this.
Good.
And it just makes the adjustment to the changes go much more smoothly.
Thanks for joining us on Everyday People.
Tune in next week for more information and resources that connect everyday people to everyday resources. For WFHB, I'm Courtney Stewart.
And I'm Stacey Goffinet.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Everyday People is produced by Courtney Stewart and Stacey Goffinet. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
And you can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
If you use iTunes, you can have this show delivered directly to you. Just go to the iTunes store, search for WFHB Daily Local News, and subscribe to our podcast.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.